John Roberts and Joel Rosenman were two of the originators of the Woodstock Festival. They used money Roberts had from an inheritance and found themselves in an undertaking far bigger than they bargained for. They collaborated on a 1974 book called Young Men with Unlimited Capital. Terry spoke to them in 1989 on the 20th anniversary of the festival. They told her they never planned on hosting a crowd of 400,000.
Our first go-round, we hoped to get about 25,000 people. That was in, say, March of 1969. By mid-April, we realized we might actually attract 35 to 50,000. By, say, early June, we were looking at 75,000. By late July, we thought improbably enough that we were going to have 100,000. And by the day before the concert, we had everybody in America.
There's a lot of interesting behind-the-scenes stories in your book. One of them that interested me was this blackmail call that you got from a member of the New York Underground. And it turned out, I think, to be Abbie Hoffman?
It was Abbie Hoffman. Of course, we have a fairly unique and different perspective about Woodstock, having been, as it were, in the boiler room constructing and running this particular operation. And most people don't know about that story, and it's in the book. But the Underground had hoped that the radical underground, I should say, had hoped that Woodstock would be a forum for their political ideas, that we would give them time on stage, that we would allow them to have booths, distribute leaflets, and so on. And it had been our very firm intention to keep this as non-political as possible. This was 3 days of peace and music. Abbie Hoffman summoned us down to his headquarters down in Greenwich Village in New York, and announced that if we did not come across with some money and some stage time and booths and so on, that he was going to make our life a misery. Nothing he could do could have made our lives more miserable than they were by that July. We'd already been kicked out of our first site. So we said, essentially, do your worst.
Which was what?
Well, his worst turned out to be he jumped up on stage during the Who's performance and was booted off unceremoniously by Roger Daltrey. Later on, I think he did manage to distribute some leaflets, but that weekend stayed, at least for the course of the weekend, resolutely non-political. It was just 500,000 people trying to have a good time.
Well, you had hoped to make a big profit on Woodstock, and you had printed up plenty of tickets, but the festival ended up a free festival, and this is how the announcement of the free festival sounded on stage.
This is one thing that I was going to wait a while before we talked about, but maybe we'll talk about it now so you can think about it, because we all have to make some kind of plans for ourselves. It's a free concert from now on. That doesn't mean that anything goes. What that means is we're going to put the music up here for free. Now, let's face the situation. We've had thousands and thousands of people come here today. Many, many more than we knew or even dreamt or thought would be possible. We're going to need each other to help each other to work this out, because we're taxing the systems that we have set up. We're going to be bringing the food in. But the one major thing you have to remember tonight, when you go back up into the woods to go to sleep, or if you stay here, is that the man next to you is your brother. And you damn well better treat each other that way, because if they don't, then we blow the whole thing. But we've got it right there.
Well, in fact, the story of how this got to be a free concert has a lot more to do with fear than benevolence. Would you tell the story of why you were forced to make Woodstock a free festival?
Okay, it's even somewhat of a misnomer as described here.
Because some people had already paid. Yeah.
Well, for some people, it was not a free festival.
Yeah.
Those unfortunate few who actually bought tickets, many of whom never were able to get to the festival because of the traffic. It certainly wasn't a free festival for John and me. It cost us roughly $3 to $4 million. But it was certainly a free festival in the legend of Woodstock, and it was definitely a free festival for the hundreds of thousands that we just heard in the background while John Morris was making his announcement from the stage.
Now, you had hoped to have, what, about 20 turnstiles that ticket holders would walk through?
We had them. We built them. The gates were up. The turnstiles were up. Ticket takers had been identified, and, in fact, their uniforms had been designed. It's really... It was really all set. Unfortunately, all of that had been constructed in Wallkill, New York, some weeks prior to the actual event. And with roughly 34 days to go, the Zoning Board of Appeals of Wallkill met one evening in response to local pressure and revoked permits that we had had for months while we finished our construction. So an entire festival construction, at great expense and effort, was out the window. We were booted from that site, and with a little more than 5 weeks to go, we had to reconstruct the entire festival site in White Lake, New York. Now, this meant that some things had to be done triple time. Overtime was very expensive, even in those days. We hired a lot more staff. We had a thousand people working at our peak, trying to recreate the festival. A couple of days before the event was supposed to start, it really came down to, do we finish the stage, or do we try to get the stage even workable, or do we build fences and ticket gates once again? At that point, it kind of was put to John and me. Are we still in this for the money? Do we take a chance with the crowd? Do we take a chance with what may be the peaceful outcome of the festival, which we had worked so hard to maintain throughout the promotion period? We thought about it for a millisecond, I think, and said, build the stage, make sure the crowd is taken care of, make sure the systems are in place to support them, and we'll worry about taking tickets later.
Now, you had planned to have a lot of off-duty New York City police to come and keep the peace at the festival. At the last minute, the police reneged on the offer because the person who had made the offer got a heart attack and his replacement didn't think it was a very wise idea. But while you were still planning on using the New York City off-duty police,
yes,
what kind of deal did you have with them? Were they going to bus people for doing illegal things like smoking marijuana and dropping LSD or walking around naked?
No, they weren't. We had rather extensive interviews and rehearsals with the off-duty policemen that we selected. In fact, we had applicants, I think over 1,000 applicants for about 300 places. And we would pose questions to them, such as, if a young man with long hair comes up to you over the course of the weekend and blows marijuana smoke in your face, what is the correct reaction? If the policeman said, I'd take my nightstick and whop him one, then we would look for another candidate. If he said, I'd smile and walk away, then we probably had the right guy. What we wanted there was not a group of people to bust the crowd. We wanted people who were tolerant, who would keep the peace, who would see that people did not hurt each other, and who basically had bought into the dream and the idea of 3 days of peace and music.
What did you do for replacements?
Well, believe it or not, most of them showed up anyway. And it was really quite amusing because they didn't use their real names. They would sign in as Mickey Mouse or Pluto or Batman or something like that. And matching up Batman with the money he was owed was, as I recall, one of the more interesting tasks after the festival. So I would say of the 300 we hired, over 250 actually showed up, and they did a fine job.
The first night of the Woodstock Festival, that Friday night, there was a terrible thunderstorm. On stage, it sounded something like this.
It looks like we're going to get a little bit of rain, so you better cover up. If it does, if we should have a slight power problem, just cool it out. We'll sit here with you. We'll be okay.
Everybody get out!
And let's keep it nice and cool. All right, everybody just sit down. Wrap yourself up.
Well, while that was happening, behind the scenes, you were all worrying about mass electrocution. What had happened electrically that was the worry?
It was a nightmare. We had been... It probably was the bleakest moment of the festival for me. We were sprouting walkie-talkies from every ear at that point and dealing with a dozen problems every minute or two. And on top of it all, the phone rang. The chief electrician was calling from backstage. I asked him what the problem was. He sounded pretty shaky, actually, at the time, even for a man who was going through what he was going through. He said, with the rain and all of those hundreds of thousands of feet scuffling over the performance area, the main feeder cables supplying electricity to the stage, the musicians, the amplifiers, whatever, have been unearthed. And with additional abrasion from these sneakers and whatever and sandals, it may wear away the insulation on these cables. I'm worried with all those wet bodies packed together that we may have something approximating a... And he paused for a moment, and I couldn't believe that he was searching for the words that he came up with, but he came up with mass electrocution. And I thought to myself, this is incredible. This can't be happening. He said, what do you want me to do? Should I shut down the power to the stage? Now, we had a philosophy there at headquarters that one of the reasons that this festival was proceeding so well, in spite of the adversities that everybody there was facing, the weather, the tremendous crowds, the strain on all facilities, was that the music was so mesmerizing. It was wonderful talent, brilliant artists performing. The kids were just in love with it. The thought of shutting the power down in the darkness, in the rainstorm, struck me as an invitation to chaos. Nevertheless, the thought of a mass execution posed additional moral problems. At that point, I remember breaking a two-year moratorium on smoking. I think I lit up three or four Camels at once and stuck them in my mouth and tried to think this one through. Finally, the electrician helped me out. He said, look, I think there's a chance that in the next 20 minutes I can work a shunt from the power source to the stage that bypasses those main feeder cables, and maybe that'll solve the whole problem. I said, give it a try, and hung up. And for the next 20 minutes, John and I sat there looking at each other. I guess we were waiting, like in the movies, for the lights to dim a little bit, the way they do when they throw the switch in the electric chair chamber. And I think it probably took 100 years for those 20 minutes to pass. The phone rang, and it was the chief electrician again. He said, I did it. Everything's fine.
Joel Rosenman and John Roberts, two of the original producers of Woodstock, speaking with Terry Gross in 1989. John Roberts died in 2001. Joel Rosenman lives in New York and runs a venture capital firm.